The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors.
It's coming fast, man. Did you all know that only 10% of elk hunters are successful elk hunters? 10%, that's it. Now, there's most likely some people tuning in that fall into that 10% category. But for the rest, what if I told you that Corey Jacobson at Elk 101 has developed an online course that'll help make you a 10%er? The University of Elk Hunting will provide you with all the resources you'll need to be confident in all areas of elk hunting, regardless of your level of experience or success. The Elk 101 online course will give you all the tools you need to become a successful elk hunter. Now listen, you know, and not to pump my own tire here, but, you know, I've had a bit of success elk hunting in the past. And I took the Elk 101 course 2 winters ago. And let's just say there's stuff that Corey covers in his modules that were not only easy to process, but they taught me some things that I didn't even know I was doing wrong. You know, and I was just totally pumped to take some of the stuff I'd learned from Corey's Elk 101 course into the field last fall. And, you know, it worked. I harvested a nice 6x6 elk. Now, you're going to have to pay for this course. It's $100. You know, $100. Think of all that money and time you waste on calls and scent blocker, camo, and all that other stuff that you don't really need. But, you know, Corey, being the class act that he is, he offered Focus Hunting listeners 20% off. Just use the promo code FOCUS. And trust me, it's going to be the best $80 you ever spend on anything to do with hunting.
Oh, it totally does, man. I give people hell on all the forums when they talk about
it's the pack out. I don't think there's anything that truly prepares you or can
staying, you know, true to your brand.
You know, you get sore and pains and stuff, but once you build up calluses everywhere, yeah.
And then I picked up running, and so I decided I should not only run marathons, but I should run ultra marathons. So
100 miles.
Yep.
Running 100 miles.
And we really just, we're looking for a better t-shirt, comfortable t-shirt.
The home of the Quebec Nordiques, as we Canadians like to say.
I'll agree with you only because I honestly don't have a clue.
Hey everybody, thanks again for tuning into the Focus Hunting Podcast. The Focus Hunting Podcast is brought to you by the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. Make sure you all head on over to waypointtv.com after this podcast. Check out what they got going on over there. This show is a show I've really been looking forward to get to you guys. I was hoping to get it to you a few days earlier, but I kind of got caught up with a long, daunting bear hunt that I'll get into a little bit later. On this episode, I'm joined by Matting Patelis. He's the co-founder of Hunt to Eat. Matting and I chat about how this great brand all got started and you know, where it's heading in the future. We touch on elk hunting, packouts, good gear, and if it's worth the cost of it. And Matting tells us all about his crazy-ass 100-mile ultra running, which to me is just nuts. Make sure you guys head on over to Hunt to Eat. check out what they got going on over there, and be sure to pick up some cool swag and check out their recipes and everything else they got going on. But just one quick side note, fellas, for you, those of you who follow hockey, you're going to hear me give my predictions on the Colorado Avalanche meeting the Boston Bruins in the Stanley Cup Finals. This obviously won't happen, seeing as they are both knocked out. So that's just evidence I have no idea what I'm talking about. But anyway, let's get after it. How you doing today?
I am well today. It's an early morning, running some errands, helping some friends out. But a good day in Denver, Colorado, where we're based out of. And yeah, it's a sunny week here, so no complaints.
Nice. How long you been down in Denver?
I've been in Denver roughly 10 years or so. Been out west, kind of away from where I grew up for actually, I think longer now than I ever was actually back in Michigan. So, I've been out west like 20 some years now.
Denver.
Yeah, it's a good place to be. Lots of good outdoor adventure opportunities, which is kind of my daily MO. So,
Good sports teams down there. That's the home of the Quebec Nordiques, as we Canadians like to say.
There might be, but I'm actually, if I have any kind of sporting affiliation, it still probably lies with the Michigan team. So I'm usually rooting for the Red Wings when they're playing the Avs.
Avs are
there's so many Michigan people here that it's actually, when they do play, it's probably more Red Wings fans than Avs fans here. So,
yeah, it's been a tough few years to be a Red Wings fan, but you guys had a good run. That's for sure. Colorado's looking good. I predict them and the Bruins in the final. Those are
okay.
Two good looking teams.
I'll agree with you only because I honestly don't have a clue. I can tell you more about what's happening in the ultra running scene or some other things than I can about actual sports ball teams.
So, yeah, man, you're checking you out your Facebook page and stuff. You're a crazy ass runner, eh? Well, we'll get into that a little later here, but maybe right off the get go, you can just give yourself a quick introduction of, you know, just who you are.
So Mating Patelis, I was I don't know where we want how far we want to go back, but essentially got into where I'm at right now with this company, with Hunt to Eat, almost coming on 8 years now. And ultimately I was I came to hunting while my family's been in hunting, you know, as long as I've been around. I didn't really participate. I didn't have the fantastic relationship with my dad that so many of us have to go out in the woods with. So I only got into hunting when I was 26 or so. And that's mostly thanks to my brother, who's the celebrity in the family. So he got me out elk hunting once I moved to Colorado. Ever since then, I kind of, for the first few years, I just hunted elk for, you know, one week a season. And slowly but surely that kind of grew into working for Meat Eater for a little bit of time. And then, ultimately, starting Hunt to Eat with my brother. And we really just, we're looking for a better t-shirt, comfortable t-shirt, a t-shirt that didn't feel like it had a sticker plastered on the front, and had some cool designs. And so that's kind of what set Hunt to Eat kind of on its course. And, had no idea, how to make a t-shirt, how to print a t-shirt. I was honestly an educator by trade, an adventure educator by trade. So dealt a lot with taking kids and anywhere from kids to adults out on rock climbing and kind of expedition trips. And landed in some kind of, after that essentially kind of petered out, so to speak, due to poor pay in that whole industry. I ended up in the outdoor gear industry and then kind of in the tech industry a little bit, and ultimately ended up kind of pursuing my passion of photography, which led me to Meat Eater. But yeah, it's kind of a roundabout way to get to being a t-shirt salesman. And so I now have been a t-shirt salesman for the last 7 years, and And slowly now that's turning into a little bit more than just t-shirts. We're actually building ourselves out as a media company now, as well as an education company. So that's fun, being able to kind of transition back to my roots of adventure education, you know, and where we are with the hunting culture these days. There's a kind of a, what we call a blue ocean opportunity with the education, in education in hunting right now. So, we are taking the first big step towards being the leader in hunting education. And then the media stuff is also kind of slowly churning out here.
You got lots going on, and you definitely transitioned from just a t-shirt selling company. But backing up a bit, you said you were you got into hunting a little later in life, but you always had a connection to the outdoors. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were a mountain guide, weren't you?
Yeah, so that's kind of mountain guide. So, I mean, I call it an outdoor educator, is what I've. My degree is technically an adventure education degree with a focus in wilderness leadership. So, I definitely spent a lot of days climbing rocks and living out of a van down by the river, and that whole kind of mountain guiding lifestyle. It was a lot of fun. I love educating folks. I love seeing people kind of see what is especially having the outdoors be the thing that that challenges people to see what they're made out of and see what they can accomplish. It's a pretty cool thing to be able to work through that with folks in the outdoors. So, I did that for about 7 years right out of college. So,
yeah, cool, man. Well, that makes that makes an easy transition into hunting, especially, if you got a mentor like your brother. And, you know, I think we're all aware of him and his success he's had in the industry. But so when you guys started Hunt to Eat, I assume it was just a side gig. Obviously now it's grown immensely. But, how long did it take you to realize that this was going to be, a full-time show?
I'd say about... Boy, full time. I think I took myself full time. I think 3 years in, something like that. Essentially, we had a pretty good first run of it. Just trying to figure. Well, it took us about 2 years to just figure out how to do stuff and not how to get swindled out of all the middlemen who are always selling you something and not doing very much. But I think about. Year three, I essentially had the warehouse was in one of my bedrooms in my house, and I was picking and packing and shipping orders every day. So that's kind of the point at which that all took off. And really, ultimately, that was first couple of years. I was just working here and there for Meat Eater, and then driving as an Uber driver and a Lyft driver. I was one of the first Lyft and Uber drivers in Denver, and that was kind of like the way I actually made some money. And then that was a side hustle. And then sooner or later, we kind of went full all in. I was trying to become a full-time photographer, and Hunt to Eat kind of beat out that work. So, then it was full-time.
7-8 years down the road. And I mean, you guys, pretty big now. How many people you got working over there full-time now?
Honestly, we still don't have any full-time employees. It doesn't necessarily look like that from the outside looking in. I know there are roughly 10 contractors that work for me on a pretty regular basis. And then there's something like, 30, contributors at this point that are all contract workers. But
oh, yeah.
It's small, running a small business is still is a challenging thing. We don't have the backing of the venture capital folks like other folks in the industry. So, we're always just trying to figure out how to make the next cool thing happen and get people's attention and keep people's attention. And, it's definitely a daily challenge.
Once you get too big and too capitalized, then, things, you kind of lose that, kinship that, you get when you stay small.
Yeah. Yeah, it's It is. I get that. It's a, you know, there's a very real conversation between earning a living and staying, you know, true to your brand, but also not doing that at the expense of earning a living. So we try to make both things happen for sure.
Yeah. So I remember back when you guys first got rolling, you guys were doing like state specific teas. You had one for Alaska and, you know, California and so on and so on. Like I said, you've evolved since then, but talk a bit about what you got going on over at your webpage.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there still are a lot of state specific stuff where we haven't gotten through all 50. Unfortunately, to a lot of people's chagrin, but we're working on it nonetheless. It's just that there's a lot, the population demands and a lot of other states demand that we, you know, just smart business to give the more folks what they want. So, you know, states like California and Colorado are probably already on their third, if not fourth, state design. And we're, you know, we're still working on a lot of the little ones out on the East Coast and whatnot, but, yeah, you'll still see, you know, the state stuff keep popping up and new stuff coming down the line. We're doing, you know, there's still a bunch of t-shirt design stuff coming. So we're always trying to keep it new and fresh. But on the website, you'll actually see a new website hit the, this is probably the first place where this is getting announced. You'll see a new website come hit the internet here in another month or so. You know, the whole kind of online editorial is there for folks to kind of, you know, for that new hunter to kind of land in the hunt to eat community and have an opportunity to not only figure out how to start hunting from the materials we're putting out, but also how to kind of stay connected in a community as well as, you know, enjoy the kind of the cooking aspect, which is, you know, I think that's for most folks coming into hunting these days, food is the vector that brings them there. So, you know, we want to showcase the foodies who are making wild game, like really, really fun and exciting. And at the same time, we also, you know, we focus a lot on the average, you know, what I call the average hunter, which is myself, really. Like, I'm not a chef by any means. Like my wife is the chef in the house, but there's still a lot of fun ways. Yeah, there's still a lot of fun ways that even us average folks can make, you know, wild game just be really amazing. Whether that's making you know, an Instapot meal that turns out really good, or just making like a better and better burger for ourselves. It's a good vector also to help, you know, even if we average folks can make that burger better. It's how we get our friends to come hunt with us, is by feeding them really good food. So, yeah, there's everything from learning how to figuring how to cook, and just kind of all the fun stories in between that. So, yeah, there's a lot of exploring people can do on the Hunt to Eat website for sure. Let alone buy some stickers or t-shirts or whatnot. So
buy some cool swag for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah. You guys, I mean, 7 years, and I didn't count how many, you know, t-shirts and hats and all the different designs you got on your website, but you got a lot of clothing available. How many new items you guys pumping out each year, roughly?
You know, it's a good question. We're somewhere design work wise, we're somewhere over 150 designs at this point that we've pumped out in the last seven, 8 years. So there's a lot. I'd say we're kind of on track that we kind of put out something new, you know, two things every month, probably on average. Sometimes it comes in a little hotter and heavier, but yeah, I'd say two a month. So.
Oh, that's pretty good. It's not easy to get a t-shirt from an idea to the shelving process. Maybe you could talk a bit about that process. Maybe you can walk us through the process of actually making a t-shirt, you know, from the idea of it to the sales rack.
Yeah. That's actually probably the most fun I get to have is that ideation aspect. which I'll say that of those 150 designs, probably, you know, the core concept of probably 100 of them have been my own, which is fun. I never thought of myself as a designer, but I definitely thought of myself as a creative. But throughout the years, we've had just a lot of really great designers work for us. And, you know, I'd see kind of something, some idea come to, you know, come to me essentially, whether it's on a long run or out walking through the woods or whatever. And, I would sketch it out on my iPad, and I draw like a fifth grader pretty much. But I would take that and kind of put whoever's style, I thought would match up with the idea the best. I'd pass it off to one of our designers, and then we would kind of go back and forth from there. So it's pretty fun looking back at all these designs where we have, you know, maybe five or six, it's like renditions of a design, everything from my initial scribble, to what the designer kind of, you know, figured out in the end, kind of seeing that progression of these designs. But, yeah, then it's, you know, the designer works on it. Maybe we do that for a week or two, and it's finished. And then, we've got a really great, print shop that we work with here in Denver, and have worked with them essentially from the beginning, for the most part, except for those first few years. So that's a really fun thing, 'cause I'm in the print shop with, the folks that work there and their main designer. And so we're working on kind of the details of the design, and how it actually unfolds on a t-shirt, and, everything from kind of the pixelation of the screens to, you know, picking out inks and testing how inks are going to work on certain shirt colors. You know, there's way more to that than most people think, particularly when you print shirts the way we do, which is a water-based print, not a plastisol print, meaning that we actually bleach the shirt gets bleached, and then the ink gets put right into the yarn, versus plastisol being a process where literally a layer of plastic gets put down on the shirt, and then that plastic gets printed on, which is why those shirts, when you put them on, if you sweat it ever, it feels like that sticker is sticking to your chest, because there literally is a plastic sticker on the front, and then there's just ink on top of that. Which I always say, friends don't let friends wear plastisol, just because it feels like garbage. It ultimately ends up cracking. It doesn't look very good, and I don't think it's worth the money it took to print it. So I'm always trying to get people to realize that if they spend marketing dollars on crappy shirts, one, not only the shirt is crappy, but then the print is crappy, they ultimately, people are going to say, great, thanks for the t-shirt, and they're going to stick it in the back of the drawer, or they're just going to throw it away and put it in the rag pile. So I don't think those shirts actually get worn as much as many people would like to think that they do. So we've been pushing people to print on good shirts and print water-based. And it's, you know, it comes out a little different. The prints aren't necessarily as crisp. They have kind of like this worn and weathered look to them. But they feel great. And you can still get some color pop. You just have to be particular about how you, you know, the inks you use and the shirts you pair them with. So, it's been a lot of fun learning that whole process. But yeah, then you deal with a warehouse, and, we've done everything from being in, other people's warehouses to now we actually have our own warehouse, and, it's great to kind of have our own systems dialed in now with Dustin here. He's managing the warehouse, and, yeah, just great to have, you know, folks who are hunters and committed to the brand, and, you know, they're kind of doing the day-to-day work in the shop here. So, you know, that gets us shirts, and we can be essentially from an idea to in the warehouse in as little as 2 weeks if we want to. Generally it's about 4 weeks, but, which is great as a small business. It essentially just gives us the ability to be quick and to kind of shift our focus when we need to pretty fast, or get cool things out quickly. Being nimble as a small company is definitely a pretty big asset.
Yeah, for sure. That goes back to what we talked about earlier. Yeah. And I seen pictures of your guys's new outfit there. It looks pretty good, man. That's
yeah, it's nice to have. We have two office. Well, we have like a kind of a front hangout room, and then we have an office next to the warehouse. And it's just honestly, after being at a home office for 7 years, it's fantastic to actually come to work.
No doubt. It's nice to work from home, but it's nice to have separation as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely.
One thing I found about clothing is it could be very frustrating. You know, I found like through my experiences, you know, sometimes, well, I mean, just the process of back and forth, I mean, emails back and forth, trying to get a design right is challenging enough. And then, you know, when it goes to print, sometimes, you know, you get crooked or uneven logos, and, you know, sometimes the shirt's just completely wrong. How did you guys kind of overcome these obstacles? I'm assuming you must have went through these headaches in the beginning.
Yeah.
First started.
No, that was just the first 2 years, man, was dealing with people who aren't designers. You know, all of our designers still are kind of on, you know, we deal with them on the internet. Yeah, just finding good designers that can, you know, that they work well with you and they take direction well. And then ultimately when it comes to the shirts and the printing process, I mean, that ultimately was, and I've had plenty of people pitch me on, we can do it cheaper and we can do it, you know, this way and that way. And it's like, the number one thing there is can I walk into the print shop and talk to the main print, you know, the main designer, the main creative director at the shop and walk through every, you know, every color choice, every size dimension issue, just all of those things. It's like, it is a in-person, experience. It is not something that is going to happen well on over the internet, or if it does, it's going to happen over a much longer period of time, right? Because ultimately I can walk into the print shop and we can have a conversation, we can have issues arise and we can deal with them, and I can do that all in a couple hours versus that being something that like, oh, that shirt's got to get sent for me to California and then for me back to California, you know, and then it's like 4 weeks later we're finally through our issues, you know, but it took a lot longer than it needed to. So I think the in-person relationship is probably like the number one thing, which is why we still have evolved with the same print shop here in Denver. And they've been in business for 30 years. So they know what they're doing, and I've established some really great business relationships and actually just really strong friendships as well with these folks, because they're committed to making our brand as good as it can be as well. So, I think you run into essentially the online stuff gets cheaper for certain reasons, and those reasons ultimately are things that kick people in the face when they're when they have to deal with them.
Yeah, you end up paying for it later on, but yeah. Yep. I guess it's just part of those growing pains that every business goes through at the beginning, eh?
Oh, it is. And I think that there are also people underestimate the idea of how many shirts they're going to sell. You know, and it's like, the reality is that scale, it takes a long time to actually scale something. And so if people think that they're going to, you know, make one design, make, you know, and sell 100 t-shirts, and they're a small business, they're fooling themselves. I mean, we still only make 25 shirts for like a brand new design. Maybe a really good one will make 30 or 40, but it's just not that's just not a reality unless you're a big business that you're going to sell thousands of t-shirts. It's not reality.
Yeah.
And small brands are going to move 10 shirts a month maybe. Mm-hmm. So it's hard because that scale, things get a lot more expensive, and then all of a sudden it takes you a lot more capital to actually build a t-shirt. And yet you're still selling it only for 20 or 25 bucks. So, you know, it's like welcome to business 101. It's not all roses.
No, man. That's for sure. So, yeah. I noticed on your webpage, you got a collaboration series. Maybe you can tell me a bit about that.
I mean, it was a good way for us to help kind of support you know, other essentially conservation focused brands, really sometimes brands, mostly nonprofits, And again, it comes down to this, like, where are people spending their marketing dollars? And there's a lot of swag made out there that just isn't good, and that most people don't want to wear. And so I figured that if people actually wear the t-shirt, you know, for Pheasants Forever or whatever like that, then they're going to get more bang for their buck. They're going to be able to tell their story a little bit better. So yeah, we essentially just started reaching out to nonprofits and offering to do the design work for free, kind of in trade for being partners with people on these projects and sharing their stories. And that's been just a good way to support that part of the kind of the conservation industry. So it's kind of tapered off a little bit here and there. It's also, you know, people love to think that you're going to sell, again, just thousands of shirts, but it's really not the case. Yeah, we've got a new, I don't know if I can actually talk about that. We've done a couple of things with Pheasants Forever, and we've got another cool one coming out with them. So I'll leave it at that. But yeah, cool. It's a great way to just support that part of the industry and get some of that messaging out there. You know, it's not, there's fun and cool ways to showcase kind of like the different pieces of everything involved in the hunting culture. Like our Western Roots shirt is actually a pretty good showcase of that, of just like talking about sage grouse habitat and kind of Western sage steppe habitat, and showing showing all the plants of that place, of that landscape. And that design has been a really great seller. So it's been fun to just kind of have that for folks. Yeah, it's actually definitely. Got, you know, it doesn't have like a game animal on it at all or anything like that, but it's just you know, there's more than just about the animals, you know, that's kind of the fun part about Hunt to Eat, is that we're always showcasing the, you know, the whole 360 and not just the hunting, not just the animal. So
yeah, that's cool, man. That's good. Awesome.
Yeah.
Now, do you guys help out or design stuff for other companies or folks that, you know, like say a podcast wants a t-shirt, do you guys help them out with that?
Or? We do on occasion. It's kind of like a business line we don't necessarily talk about a lot, but we do design work. We just did some design work for another nonprofit. So yeah, I mean, that definitely is, you know, we've got partnerships like with Hank Shaw, where we, you know, we do all his design work and then sell all his gear, just so he can focus on what he does best, which is write cookbooks and kind of tour around and sell those things. But, yeah, it's fun to have those kind of partnerships with other folks that, you know, there's a lot to figuring out how to deal with, you know, selling merchandise, and organizing a warehouse and all that stuff. So again, not ever anything I thought I would do as a job, but now we do it pretty well. So it is fun to help people out with that stuff.
Yeah. And it's frustrating as all hell too. It can be.
Yeah.
Well, if you can get somebody else experienced to help you out with it, it's worth it for sure. We talked earlier a bit about the food being a huge part of Hunt to Eat. And, you know, in my household, my wife, she runs the kitchen. She doesn't even let me in there very often. I burn toast. So it's, I'm not much of a cook. It's something I've tried to work on the last few years, but, you got a ton of recipes over there. Yeah. Where do you guys acquire all this good looking food?
You know, that's like, I'll say that's probably the number one place where the kind of the Hunt to Eat community comes into the fold, is just, it's all just community source for the most part. We're generally these days have moved to a kind of a paid contributor model. So we definitely have a lot of that going on as well, as far as, you know, YouTube channel and whatever, but, yeah, there's just so many people in the community that want to share what they're doing with their wild game and kind of how they've, you know, maybe changed a known recipe to be kind of more wild game specific or whatnot. But yeah, it's just fun to have people share from the community what they're doing with their food. So I'd say that's probably the biggest part.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff on there. So do you guys test all these recipes out, or do you go through them before you throw them up on your webpage?
I'll say that they're tested by we kind of distrust the community to give us good stuff.
Yeah, well, they sure look good, man. Do you have a favorite or hit me up with your top five?
Top five, oof. I would say I honestly give you like top three maybe. I'm definitely a fan of essentially either shanks or like turkey legs. Anything if I can take shanks or turkey legs and throw them in the Instapot, my go-to these days is to literally just go like a can of beer, a can of lager, and then a box of like chicken stock, and then whatever focused spice I want to do, which usually would just be one kind of like pre-made seasoning, and chuck all that in there and put it on for 6 hours, and ultimately you end up with just like falling off the bone meat that's delicious. And then with most of that stuff, I'll ultimately like I'll fry it a little bit, so it's kind of like carnitas, it's awesome. It's delicious. And that's kind of like cooking for dummies, I think, is like the Instapot or just any slow cooker essentially. But all those shanks and all that leg meat, man. I mean, all that connective tissue just breaks apart and makes everything delicious. So,
especially when you add beer to it.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I think that's a fad that people are definitely seeing, that like they used to throw away shanks or, they used to just grind all that meat. And it's kind of like people are learning now that you just got to give it time in the slow cooker and it'll all fall apart sooner or later. And it's great. So that's my number one probably. And then, I'm really just a fan of a good burger. And I'm a Tony C's seasoning fan. A good burger like that. And then jerky schnitzel is also like a big fan favorite at our house. Ultimately, because I end up making them like with schnitzel on a bun, I'll do barbecue sauce, pickles, and cheese. And that's just like I'll call it the world's best chicken sandwich that's not a chicken. those are my kind of go-tos. And then other just fan favorites in the house, but that I can't claim them, is my wife will do she'll make pastrami these days, and we'll make Reubens. And that's just a fantastic, I mean, like if people are into sandwiches, folks that don't maybe hunt wild game, if they're into a good sandwich, they're probably into a Reuben. And if you can, make a good pastrami and cut and thin slice it, then, Reuben's a good way to get people interested into it, because they really have no idea that it's actually wild game.
Yeah, that's one cool thing about recipes like this is, when you do get a chance to prepare them for, somebody who is a non-hunter, and then they're willing to eat it. And then they, most of the time it's, it's always a positive on how good it was. So, yeah. That's what makes these recipes a lot of fun. Yeah, I was looking for a good bear recipe this morning on your Hunt Eat webpage. Found a few there, so I'll have to try those out.
Nice. Yeah, we haven't messed around too much with it. I got some bear fat from our marketing manager Gabby last year, but I have yet to shoot a bear, so it's on my radar of hunts I want to get after. But unfortunately, I don't even think that this fall I'm going to have to. I'm gonna have to turn in my bear tags. I don't even have time to actually go chase one. Yeah, maybe, I think next spring, hopefully, I've got a plan to get up to Montana maybe and try to get after a bear. So it'll be my first one.
Yeah, cool, man. So, I got a couple other things I wanted to ask you about, but sure. Is there anything else you wanted to add about the clothing and the webpage?
I don't think so. I think just if folks are kind of getting into it, stay tuned. We got a lot of fun stuff coming. New website, like a couple of new big announcements coming in the next few months here. So, there'll be other ways that you can kind of tune into the Hunt Eat community, which will be fun. So just kind of stay tuned. And then, if you're in the States and you're a brand new hunter and you want to learn how to hunt, then we've got the educational, the hunt camps. And so those are really geared towards, you know, total novices in hunting, maybe never even hunted at all, maybe never even shot a gun before, but you can come to a hunt camp experience and we'll walk you through the whole thing. So that's, we'll have those up on the website here soon. We've probably got somewhere 10 to 15 camps this fall that people can come experience everything from bear hunting to deer, to upland, to waterfowl. So there'll be a lot of different opportunities.
Yeah, that's a great idea, man. There's that's one of the biggest obstacles, I think, for new hunters is just that lack of mentorship.
Yep. So yeah, we'll offer the mentorship and then we'll offer the community for people to stay involved and keep learning.
Yeah, so. Definitely. So outside Hunt to Eat, you're pretty active. We touched early on ultra running. What's ultra running? What's the difference from that from just regular old jogging?
Well, I still jog, although I might not say that. I might say I go for a run, but it's just longer, I guess, is though really. I mean, an ultra marathon is anything that's over, I don't know if people get technical about it, but it's essentially anything over a regular marathon. And yeah, I kind of got into running with my wife when we met like 8 years ago. I'm kind of an all or nothing guy. So I went from being a rock climber 300 days a year to racing bikes a whole bunch and kind of being a pro-am bike racer. And then I picked up running. And so, of course, I decided I should not only run marathons, but I should run ultra marathons. So, I'm actually, I just finished up a huge block of training and now I'm 12 days out from, my second attempt at 100 miles.
100 miles.
Yep.
Running 100 miles.
Yeah.
How long does that take?
Well, if I have a good day, it'll be somewhere around 18 hours. If I have a mediocre day, it'll be somewhere, you know, 22 to 24. And ultimately, I'm just going to try and finish. So the 30-hour cutoff for the race. Hopefully, Jesus. It's under 24 hours. Yeah.
So how the hell do you train for something like that? Because it's not like you can just go running 100 miles a day.
No. It's just, you know, like with any endurance training, there's just like a bunch of periodization, as they call it. So just doing different stuff at different times of the year to try to boost all of the kind of the mechanics of running. And, you know, I like the last 2 weeks I put in right around 60 miles for the week. So, which isn't crazy. I mean, there's plenty of pro runners that are, you know, that run 100 miles a week. You know, once you get into that, I'd say probably the average jogger, average runner, if you will, you know, gets in somewhere between 15 and 20, 25 miles a week. But once you start to get over that kind of like 35, 40 and into the 60 range, your running just really takes off. So, and you just start building up the endurance. So, you know, different years I've had different kind of strategies from being a self-coached athlete, but you know, you read enough books and you do enough kind of figuring out of how your body responds to training stimulus. And it's a lot of big back-to-back days. So like I did, last week I had some days where I ran like, you know, 15, 15, 15, thereabouts, kind of like 45 miles over the course of 3 days. Doing some shorter races, some 50Ks, things like that, you know, like a month ago. This year I'm actually running a marathon a month, just as a way to stay consistent in my running. But that's actually been kind of like it was a good thing early in the year to kind of get me going. It's actually been a bit of a boon right now because it's not necessarily the best way to running a marathon. Takes a lot out of you. So doing it every 4 weeks is not necessarily the best training methodology, but I've been able to do it nonetheless. So, I don't know. That's,
Wow.
That's the short of it, I guess.
So, do you guys stop when you're on these, on the, like a 24-hour run, do you stop to
rehydrate?
No, you're
yeah, you've got aid stations, you've got, you know, you got pacers, you've got a crew. So my wife and my dad, and a couple of friends will be out there, crewing me, and, you know, so they'll see me early on. They probably won't see me as much, 'cause I'll kind of run through the aid stations, and it's a lot easier when you're not super fatigued. But once we get to the, like, 60 mile range, then, you know, then I'll see them every 5 miles or thereabouts. And, yeah, they're there to make sure you're eating and drinking enough. And, you know, unfortunately, because it's such a long time frame, you also try to, while you do stop and have a seat and, you know, drink some food, drink some water, whatever, eat some food, you try not to sit around too long, 'cause you can just kind of seize up and kind of just lose your mojo. So, and just all that time, right, in a race, all that time is counting against you as well. So, the last 50K I did, you know, I actually only had 8 minutes at aid stations, which is really good. It's essentially running in, filling up my stuff, and running out. And then ultimately, like, you know, you're still walking plenty in these races. You can't actually, I mean, there, don't get me wrong, the professionals do run the whole thing. This race is pretty flat. And so I'll actually, my pacing strategy will be to actually run 3 miles, walk for 10 minutes, and repeat for 24 hours or however long it takes me. So, gives my body a little bit of a break, from the monotony of running, on flat terrain, and kind of like break up my, the biomechanical issues that might arise from doing it the same way and over and over and over again for hours on end.
No doubt. And your body's been good. It's held up. Knees are good.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think that's a funny misconception, man. The whole, my knees hurt thing. And definitely, don't get me wrong, when I first started running and I had not been a runner, it took me about 2 years, to get past sore knees. But, now I don't have any knee issues whatsoever. There's plenty of ultra runners, or just runners in general, will tell you that, like, you certainly have to get over it. You have to get your body used to it. But once you do, the knee issue just, it goes away. I can run a marathon these days and not be sore. So it's just what you're prepping your body to do, you know?
Yeah. I think it's just one of those, like anything with training or any exercise at the beginning, it's, you know, you get sore and pains and stuff, but once you build up calluses everywhere, you don't even notice it.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, man. When I wasn't a runner, the first time I ran, I think it was at the end of my bike racing days. I ran a mile, and the next day I couldn't walk. I was so sore. Right. And like everyone's got to start somewhere with that stuff. It's just whether or not you let it, stop you, I think, from responding to the stimulus, and then, you know, and then getting better. So how many
people go in these 100-mile races?
This one's kind of a small race. This one came up last minute. I actually was in a different race, and through some weird COVID miscommunications and whatnot, I actually got booted out of the race that I was supposed to be in, which was in Milwaukee. So I found this race last minute on the same weekend, but in Michigan. So, I think in this one, in the 100-mile, there will probably be somewhere around 70 participants. But man, ultra running is boomed. Like, I think a year or two ago, there was something like maybe like 60,000 people participating in ultra running races in the United States. And then in the last year, it's something over like 300,000. It's just like, it's exploded. So a lot of the big races, you know, there's lottery systems, much like, you know, we're trying to get, you know, get tags or whatnot through lotteries. There's a lot of races that are like that as well, where where we have preference points, they have, you know, you've got to run a certain race to actually get a qualifying ticket to get you in the lottery, to get into that race. So it can be quite the process, you know, a multiple year process just to get, entries into the lottery, and then let alone win the lottery.
Well, man, good on you. I bet, all that long distance running helps, when you're in the backcountry, I bet.
Oh, it totally does, man. It's I give people hell on all the forums when they talk about walking around with heavy backpacks and stuff. I honestly don't ever do that. Never have. I just run a lot. And what I ultimately, you know, I think a lot of folks coming, particularly into elk hunting, or, you know, they want to come hunt big Western mountains, is that they worry so much about what it's going to be like to get that animal out of the backcountry. And they don't worry enough about what it takes to actually just find the animals and pursue them. And don't get me wrong, there are days when I finally shoot an elk and then I got to carry a heavy load and it's unpleasant. But it's not something that's like impossible. If folks show up to the mountains and they're still overweight and they're like, I can carry 100 pounds, no problem, but they're so heavy that they can't actually, you know, walk 15 miles a day up and down mountains and do it quickly, they actually never catch up to the elk. They never find them. And then like, well, great. You can pack one out, but you never could catch up to one. So what's it matter?
Yeah.
So I always say that people should not worry as much about being, you know, with the strength component, but they really should just lose weight and be able to march around the mountains for as long as they possibly can. That'll make them more successful elk hunters.
Yeah. You definitely need that endurance. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, I covered 77 miles and like some 15,000 vertical or 17,000 vertical in my last week of elk hunting last season, you know, and that last day, don't get me wrong. I mean, we had three pack outs and I did we got a whole bull out, in three backpack loads. And I carried a 55-pound pack, a 75-pound pack. And then my one buddy carried a 105-pound pack. And that was an entire elk out. So, you know, those miles sucked. My hips hurt, but like, whatever. At the end of the day, you do that a couple of times and it's not that bad. And that was 4.5 miles in, you know, we did 17 miles that day to get that thing out of the woods.
Yeah. It's not easy, but you know, it's only once a year. And I don't think there's any training you can really do for that. You know what I mean? To make it so that's easier or that's pleasant. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's always a thrill when you take down an elk, but
yeah,
it's the pack out. I don't think there's anything that truly prepares you or can save you from the misery of packing an elk out.
Not really. I mean, you might carry a backpack up and down a hill once or twice just to get your hips accustomed to that weight. And so they're not so like totally bruised sore, but, other than that, I think, I don't know. The other thing is I think that a lot of people carry way too much stuff with them when they're actually out on day hikes or on day hunts. And so they go like trudging around the mountains on their training days with like 45 pounds in their backpack. And it's like even in a winter kind of like third season elk hunt in Colorado, my pack doesn't weigh more than like 15 pounds with all my stuff in it. So it's like not a heavy backpack to like have in the mountains, you know what I mean? So I'm just not a fan of the let's go, you know, grunt around with 45 pounds on our pack just to like hammer our knees home. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Oh, and yeah, they do. And I mean, when you add an animal to it, I mean, you should only have to do that once to learn your lesson. I know I did. You do it once and then you pack an animal and you're like, okay, well, I don't need this. I don't need this. I don't need this. You
can really
narrow it down to what you need, especially for a day hunt. You don't really need a whole lot. That's for sure.
Yeah. Or, and you just get, that's also where, you know, having the investment in good gear that's really lightweight makes a lot of sense. Because it's not that I forego having good or having the right equipment. It's just, I have the right equipment and it's really light. It's also expensive. Don't get me wrong, but, that makes it all comfortable, right? It makes the suffering not so bad when you actually have the right gear.
And you know,
it takes experience.
Yeah, exactly. And I find it funny, you know, I talk to a few guys and they'll go out and they'll spend, you know, $5,000 on a rifle and then they'll put, you know, I mean, it's good to have great optics, but you know, by the time they're walking out of the firearm store, they're carrying, you know, an $8,000 firearm. And then, you know, they're going right to Canadian Tire to buy some gear for the backcountry. And it's, you know, you don't really need that, that gun.
No, you can. I mean, the amount of like a Savage three, Savage makes some guns that are like $300, man, that are just, they'll, you know, they shoot straight and they,
yeah, right out of the box.
You know, a 30-06 shoots great. You know, you put a Vortex scope on it for $400. Scopes cost more than the gun, and you're out, yep, the door for $700. Yep. Take that other $5,000 and put it into, you know, a good pair of binos and,
yeah,
and a solid tent and a, you know, $400 down jacket and like all that stuff, and you're still not spending all that money. No, it's funny. I actually won a really nice rifle from a wall of guns raffle that an organization did, and I just sold it because it's just like, you know, $3,000 gun. It's just like so unnecessary for me. I have one or two guns and just like didn't need that expensive thing. So reinvested into another trip or another big plane ticket somewhere else. That'll be a cool trip instead.
No doubt. Are you a rifle hunter, archery hunter, or you mix it up?
I have done both. I've got two seasons under my belt with a bow, hunting elk. I was fortunate enough to shoot an elk my first season with a bow.
Oh, nice. Which is
a huge deal. Yeah, I know for sure that was. And then the second season, I wounded an elk, which is always a really big bummer. But yeah, he came, it was, you know, great hunt. And he just came in and presented a shot that I shouldn't have taken and put an arrow right in his scapula. And he essentially kicked it out and walked away with no blood trail. So I think he lived to bugle another day, and that was a massive bummer, but you know, a lot to learn from those experiences as well. So
yeah.
And then this year, I don't think that I don't even know that I will maybe hunt elk, but right now, with how busy we are in the early season, I'm not focused too much on archery. It's mostly just rifle. So actually in this year's elk hunt that I potentially have a tag for is really just a conservation hunt, which will be mostly walking into a field and just shooting a cow out of a herd.
Oh, yeah.
We're trying to manage. So it's more of a grocery store hunt than anything, but some years you got to take the easy ones.
Definitely, man. And that's some good meat right there. So is elk a general open season tag for you guys in Colorado?
It can be. There certainly is an over-the-counter option. It gets a little bit, you know, people love to complain about how busy all those places are, but yeah, it's still totally doable to get an over-the-counter tag and just go get it done. The most of those are bull only. So they've got to be at least a 4-point bull. There's some regulations around kind of what they have to be, but yeah, it's fun. That's what I had last year, was an over-the-counter bull tag, and I got it done. So
We have a
good thing to be a Colorado resident for sure. I think there's a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. We have we've got the same GOS, but it's 6-point for us up here, so
Wow.
Yeah, man. So how about spring turkey? You get out to do any spring turkey on?
I did. I got out a whole bunch. We had a bunch of different camps that we did. We did a big camp in Texas, and then we did one in Oklahoma. And then I was out in New York as well for just another film project that we're working on. So I actually was able to, I shot two birds in Texas. And then I shot one bird in New York. And then I did a huge road trip, but like for almost 5,000 miles on the truck over 3 weeks. And then on the way home, I swung through Nebraska for about 18 hours, and I got it done there as well. So got 4 birds down this year. So yeah, super psyched. I love wild turkey.
Man, I love and I hate hunting wild turkey. I tell you, I had no luck this year, but I still love it. I said I was done with it, but I'm slowly getting over it. I'm licking my wounds. I'm getting better.
Yeah. It's challenging, man. It's challenging for sure. But when it's so good, when it's good,
oh yeah, man.
When they're talking to goblin, it's it's not quite the same as an elk, but it's very close. Close.
When it hits, that's awesome. It's all worth it when it hits, that's for sure. Okay, dude, I think I'm gonna wrap this up. Where can the good people up here in Canada find you guys?
Yeah, so I mean, we are shipping to Canada. I'm sorry, it's a little bit more expensive as that happens, but I believe we have figured out all of the issues to shipping there. So we do offer shipping to Canada. And yeah, you can find me on Instagram. Generally, that's the best place, just Mateng. If you search that, I generally will be the first and only thing that pops up, I think. And then Hunt to Eat, of course, on Instagram as well. Those are kind of the IG is definitely the best place to find me.
Yeah. And the web page is Hunt to Eat, T-O, not the number two.
Actually, if you punched in the number two, it would still redirect you there as well.
Oh, is that right?
But Hunt to Eat, you should Google it one way or the other, and we should be the first thing that pops up. So, yeah.
Awesome. Okay, man.
Cool. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll be working on some Canadian provinces here shortly, and we'll get some design ideas from. We're always taking design ideas from our, you know, from the community members. So if you're Canadian listening to the podcast and you want to tell me what we should put in all the province designs, then shoot us an email over at customer-service at hunttoeat.com.
Awesome.
You can give us your tidbits about what we should put on designs. So
no doubt. Okay, cool, man. We'll look for that, and we'll also look for the new webpage.
Cool. Sounds good. Thanks for the time.
Okay, man. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Yeah.
Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV. The destination for outdoor entertainment.